Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this next session on what does blockchain mean for cybersecurity. I'm delighted to welcome Jaya Ballou, who is the CISO at KPN Telecom, to share her views on this and her thoughts. Jaya won the Cybersecurity Executive of the Year Award in 2015. She works with an amazing information security team of highly driven specialists, and she's worked in the industry for the past 18 years. So I'm delighted to welcome Jaya up to the stage. Thank you.
Hey guys. Thank you so much for joining me during, like, probably what's your lunchtime? Yes? We've eaten? All right. Cool. Because first I want to kind of start with something. How many of you currently have Bitcoins? Okay. How many of you have partners with Bitcoins? Okay. Cool. And I wonder if you recognize the signs of addiction. How many of you recognize the signs of addiction with your Bitcoin fetishists? Yes? So I thought this was really funny because it's really like the case. You can either have it yourself or you notice it when you're like avidly looking for places where you can pay with Bitcoin. When your partner's like hiding behind the menu because you're gonna be like, hey, can I play with Bitcoin again? And when you think that Bitcoin is the answer to everything. Because there is so much hype in this area about what, you know, Bitcoin means now, but also what it can mean in the future. And if you see the price rise as well, it would be silly not to do something about it. So, you know, what we're going to talk about is blockchain, which is the enabling technology for things like the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. And, you know, there was a sort of promise made to you, and fundamentally what we're supposed to be talking about is to answer one real question. Is blockchain the next frontier, or, you know, the next big grand challenge, if you will, for cybersecurity, or does it actually present more problems for us than it's actually promised to solve? So we look at it like a panacea. You know, like, I've been reading reports about how Bitcoin is and blockchain are going to help us figure out issues with longevity. So before we just go along with the hype and the panacea, let's look at the potential pitfalls. So that's what I'm hoping you're going to get out of this, you know, 40-minute talk today. And the way that we're going to do it is, I'm going to try to answer 10 questions in 30 minutes so we can actually have a talk later. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to do a bit of definition leveling because there weren't all the hands up, so I'm just going to make sure we're all on the same page. We're going to talk about why it's so exciting, so what the panacea is. We're going to talk about who we think may have invented it, like where the heck did this thing come from. Common understanding, also how it works, what can it do, who's doing it, what are the most common examples, what are the information security concerns we've got with it, and obviously you're probably going to, for those of you that didn't have your hand up, you know, what do I do? Where do I invest? Just tell me where to sign up because it's supposed to be great. So when will the blockchain singularity arrive? And with the blockchain singularity, it's a little bit of a pun, but it's when, you know, there's like the perfect storm of solutions where we're not more concerned with our privacy and your security than about actually using this technology. So if we actually take a look about what it is, it's actually something that's been around for quite some time. In fact, there's like papers that talk about a global distributed mutual ledger since 1976. You know, we've been talking about these kinds of distributed database systems. But like, we haven't actually been talking about blockchain and Bitcoin to that extent until we actually had, you know, this idea about the revolutionary possibilities that could go with it. And there is a reason for that. But let's take a look at why everybody's so excited about this. If you guys have time, there's a really cool movie. You can actually see it to its full extent on YouTube. It's like a blockchain movie. Has any of you already seen it? Just like go to YouTube and type in, oh, there's one hand. Okay, cool. So go to him. He knows the link. Put your hand up again. No. Oh, he put his hand down. Okay. But the idea is there's this really good movie, and it actually has all these people who keep reaffirming the phase that they are so excited about it. So what's there to be excited about? Well, IBM is not someone to sneeze at, and they actually see this as a mechanism to look of a way to enable IoT devices to securely have ledgers for inclusion. Because right now we have a sort of rampant wild growth of IoT devices that we can't control. So it's really interesting to think about ways to get them protected. And we think that blockchain, or IBM thinks that blockchain could be a way to manage these devices. Another one is around IoT security, where we're actually looking at embedding like very small modules, tiny little cryptographic modules, which have, you know, low consumption in actual IoT devices using blockchain. Another one is Tile Pay, which will actually allow you to control the access of who's allowed to access these IoT devices. You guys, how many of you just saw the talk from Bruce Schneier? Right. So you know what I'm talking about. Think about actually being able to solve some of the problems that he presented during his talk with some of these actual actions from the blockchain. And then there's another one which is talking about drug safety. It's a total different shift where we're looking at, you know, having sensor devices to make sure that the chain of drugs that we get has not been tampered with and is tamper resistant by actually having some sort of accreditation system that's built on this assertion that's provided by blockchain. And I really like the last one. The last one is really quite funky. And it's actually based on the fact that, you know, Bionic, which is coming out of Berkeley University, is using something called Gridcoin to control access to the supercomputing powers of this network cloud infrastructure they have. But they're looking for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's pretty funky. If you're not excited by it, I'm excited by that. So I think this is actually really cool. It's not just hype. You know, if there is even like 1% of truth to some of the stuff that's being sold along with what this is capable of, I'm buying. And that's why I think it really makes it interesting for computer scientists, cryptographers, and business people to be involved and to be involved early with these kinds of implementations. So now, you know, there's the question, okay, so let's figure out what the provenance is. Let's figure out where this thing came from, who thought about it. Let's give that guy a Nobel Peace Prize or something, because it's going to do all this great stuff. And the paper was a paper that was called Bitcoin Peer-to-Peer Electronic Cash System. I very much recommend you read it. It's 9 pages. It's just 9 pages. And it presents the earliest idea of what a Bitcoin protocol would look like. Yeah? And it's, you know, here's the address. There you go. And this guy, let me see if this pointer works. This guy is apparently named Satoshi Nakamoto, but he has vehemently denied being the creator of Bitcoin, vehemently. And then you have this guy, Craig Wright, who was claimed to be the creator, but he was purported by who I think is someone who actually propelled it, which is Gavin Andreessen, who actually really was the father of making sure that Bitcoin.org got to the place where it got to and kept pushing it to the area that it's in now. He's recently retired, but he even recently wrote a blog about regretting trying to figure out who Satoshi Nakamoto is. The one thing you won't miss in any of the stories around blockchain or Bitcoin is a very high level of drama. There's a lot of drama here, and I'm not sure exactly why there's such a high level of drama, but the real father of I think everything that we see now with Bitcoin and this the interest in blockchain is actually coming from this guy. And he has just taken a step back from everything that he actually initially created, his life's work, in essence. So you want to ask yourself, what does this mean? Also, another interesting thing to note is that the real Satoshi Nakamoto is probably sitting on a little pile, very nicely early mint, of Bitcoin. So even just from that principle, it's interesting to understand the provenance, because some of that mining capacity that was very early on was given to him. So let's try to figure out how it actually works. So Bob's a buyer. Bob wants to put a transaction in. He takes this transaction, he like basically announces it to the entire network to make sure, hey, is it cool? I'm going to do this. And then the miners in the network then get to work. They actually have to demonstrate that they're working on this transaction. So then they approve and validate this transaction, basically like computing the hash of it. We're going to go through that in a second. Once they've done that, it's then added to the rest of the chain. See the little chain? This original block is called like the Genesis block. It's the start of the rest of the chain. So every new transaction set and every new block just gets added, and it gets computationally harder because you started here and then you keep computing. And every once in a while, there might be an orphan block or other stuff that's happening, but you keep computing all along until you keep adding. So that chain gets longer and longer, increasing the computational difficulty. Yeah? That's why it's really easy to mine stuff and do this in the beginning when it's like smaller. And as it gets larger and bigger and more distributed, the harder it becomes. Everybody still with me? All right. Okay, so once we do this, then Sally is like, all right, cool, look, the block is added, it's public, it's permanent, it's non-reputable, and it's transparent. So everybody in here gets to see what's happened. So we all get to see that we all voted yes, it's good, all right? And whoever got the good first, whoever said, yup, it makes sense, I've got there, they win the little prize of a bit of fee for actually doing this mining, actually figuring this out, they get to get the kickback for it, okay? We all still with me? This is how they make money. This is why it's interesting. This is the incentivization program to be involved in that part of doing this. There's obviously an incentivization for Bob, who's buying stuff, and for Sally, who's selling stuff. Their incentivization is clear, right? But now you've figured out why everybody else is trying to help them, okay? And then Sally then receives the money in cryptocurrency from Bob, and now she can go ahead and send it. And it's also really cool because Bitcoin allows you to do a whole bunch of other things too. There's like add-on features like escrow. So you know how now when you do stuff on eBay with like cash, you have no clue who this person is. You don't know if you can trust them. You don't know if you're going to get whatever you paid for, and you don't know if the reverse is going to happen either. That sucks. So maybe I'm thinking it sucks a bit too much, but you have to understand I have three children and a lot of like stuff to get rid of on eBay. So this is a personal frustration. And actually, this then makes life a lot easier because you know what you're getting and it actually works and you get to follow through. So let's take a look a little bit more in detail about what these blocks really look like. So basically, this is a logical chain. So you have a set of transactions. It needs to get into the block, and it needs to be hashed. When it gets hashed, what we do is we then compute a hash below a particular target value. So once we do that, if we've got to that target value, that little threshold we got to do, and we won, remember, like we're all mining, and there's a target value determined, and if we get there first before someone else, then it's a yes, and we go, yay! We won. So the new block is added with your computed hash to the rest of the thing. And this is your proof of work. Okay, this is how you actually demonstrate that you've computed this correctly and you get to go to the, you know, collect your money. But if you didn't collect it and somebody else, another miner, found a better hash and actually could mine the block, then you're going to try to go back and try to increase the nonce and do something else. Okay, you're going to try to find more to compute. So you go to the nonce, you see another set of transactions, you hash the previous block, which is x minus 1, and then you combine it again, go back to the hash, get to the target value, maybe it's a no, you go back. If it's a yes, you win. Okay? This is a little bit more detailed than the last time. Are we still with me? Okay. All right. So now what I'm going to show you is, if we just saw that transaction, right, between Alice and Bob, we saw that one little transaction, right, buyer-seller. So let's take a look at how many transactions we actually see. So let's take a look at, you know, what a transaction visualization would look like. And there's these really funny people called Bitbonkers that, for fun, decided to make a graphical representation that is, like, near real time on their website. So if you want to just check it out, it's just for entertainment purposes only, but go see what they've done. It's really, really neat. But I've got a little video for you that kind of shows you. So what you want to watch here is, obviously, the big blocky thing is the block. The big blue ball there, that's between 100 and 1,000 Bitcoin that's just been transacted. All the little red ones, you see the lot of red ones? Those are less than one Bitcoin. The green one are between 1 and 10 Bitcoin. The big, like, well, not the big, the medium orangey balls are between 10 and 50 Bitcoin. So you see that this transaction is going to keep happening. And, you know, this video that I made, it's just a snippet. It's about 40 seconds. So in that 40 seconds, you see all these transactions happening kind of live, and it's pretty neat. But the idea that you want to remember is that this is happening continuously. So when you take a look at the actual amount of average transactions per block, then you see a ton. This is blockchain. This is, by the way, that's confusing. This is actually a cryptocurrency. So when you take a look at the actual average number of transactions per block, it actually goes way more than that. Yeah, we are talking about thousands of transactions. So you really need to like imagine this on steroids, this video, because you see a lot of transactions happen at the same time. So let's take a look at another nifty feature of the blockchain, which is smart contracts. And the funky thing is, it's not just buying and selling like your baby clothes. You can also buy and sell your house, where you normally need all of these intermediaries. You know, you need the real estate agents, you need the banks, you need probably some sort of fiduciary instance to help you do all this stuff, and registration and clearinghouse and settlement. You don't need the same thing, because basically you're going to have a match between the buyer and the seller of this sort of Bitcoin blockchain registry, and this is based on something called Ethereum. So Ethereum is basically built on top of Bitcoin, and it actually allows you to enable these smart contracts, which has this sort of decentralized, you know, but almost autonomous way for you to arrange it. How many of you bought your own house by yourselves without any real estate agents? Imagine now buying it without any banks. You see what I'm trying to get to? If we would do this, this would be crazy. I mean, all the middlemen, how much, when you bought your house, what were the fees that were calculated for that purchase? 10%, 15%? If we were to remove those fees, just think about the financial motivation to do something like this and to actually have a binding contract that's public, open, and transparent, and that you could actually engage with this with, like, a non-repudiative veneer, so that there's no way that someone can then later go renege on the deal. It's pretty funky. But what I find even funkier is there's a flip side to this. So how many of you have a Fitbit or another smart gadget that tells you how many steps or something you need to take today? All right. Imagine that thing giving you like actually like a negative thing when you didn't do your steps. So we only have the positive incentivation of get your butt moving. But imagine that we have like something called a health coin, and that your insurance company wants you to do this in order to reduce your insurance premium. And so your doctor says, you know what, you really need to move more. You're not making your 10,000 steps a day. And then you got to go ahead and do it, and then you get this health coin. And basically, that health coin could be on this Fitbit, or it could be on something else, or it could be given to you by your insurance company. And they can determine your premium based on this shared ledger. And they can say, if you do everything you're supposed to do, you get rewarded or penalized. So, you know, depending on how you use the implementation, it could actually be very beneficial or be a pain in the butt. So if you look at the other things that it can do, because we kind of talked about moving value payments and transfers and purchases, but what about authenticating identities? What about accounting for like new corporate governance structures where you actually have chains of trust within your corporations? When you insure and value manage risk, and we talked about the insurance example, but take it a step further. So between insurance companies and funding and investing in assets and exchanging value or speculating or, you know, taking away a lot of the things that currently our like global exchanges do now. You know, lending, value, credit, mortgage, we just talked about it, but this is really the full types of things that you could do with it. It goes far beyond just using a cryptocurrency. And I think that's really what the clue is. The Bitcoin made it possible for us to look at the rest, but it is not the rest. So when you look at actually who's doing it and what the most common examples are of this type of technology, of course there's currencies, and there's a lot of currencies, and there's more currencies coming out every day. And we shouldn't confuse value of a currency with the price of a currency. The price of a currency is determined on the buying or the selling thereof, right? Are you guys still with me? We determine the value of a dollar with how many people want to buy the dollar and how many people want to sell the dollar. And it's usually against another currency like the euro or the pound. Well, the same holds true for the prices of cryptocurrencies. Their price is held against another currency. So it can be the price of Bitcoin against the euro, or the price of Bitcoin against the pound. But that is not the designation of value. The designation of value is all the other stuff you could do with it. So if you think that the value of Bitcoin is only the price of it, then we're wrong. Because the value of Bitcoin is also the things that we can do with it. For example, with what I just showed you now with the smart contracts and Ethereum, etc. So we really need to think about separating value and price when it comes to these kind of currencies. Okay, so we also have a whole ecosystem in the mix because we have a way to hold and transfer these things with wallets and payments. We have actual systems that are built on to add additional features like the smart contracts. We have additional features like verifiable data players who want to basically make sure that something exists and then manage that data asset. We also have other digital assets that are out there. There's so much that I could spend like a half an hour just talking to you about this. But I urge you, like, these slides will be open and distributed. Just take a look. You know, if you think about something you'd like to use it for yourself or for your company, just take a look. When it comes to information security, there are quite a few concerns. Because I just spent the first half of this talking to you about how cool it is, right? It sounds really cool. There's all this additional functionality. It's going to make your life better. There's an enormous financial incentivization in order to do this. But there are also attacks. So from the very beginning, one of the things that the makers of blockchain and Bitcoin were worried about was the double spend attack. What happens if the person who's holding the Bitcoin tries to spend them twice? And it usually happens actually close to the end of the chain. This is one of the reasons that when you actually have these transactions, there's a little bit of a delay lag. There's a delay lag because when you're actually computing a block, it's roughly about 10 minutes. They suggest that you wait about 60 minutes before you consider a transaction fully done, because especially when you're moving large amounts of cash, it is a concern that there's no other attacks and that thing is fully validated and it's gone through the chain successfully. So the double spend attack is a concern, but it's one of the things that with the protocol, when implemented correctly and monitored for any type of double spend attacks, should be able to be done well. The other concern is around anonymity and privacy. This is not anonymous. It has pseudo-anonymity built in, but it's not fully anonymous. So there are ways in order to make that possible by extending on the original principles of Bitcoin. You can do this, for example, with other cryptocurrencies like Zcash, which is using zero-knowledge proofs to basically do an attestation without having all of the information themselves. There's also something called a Sybil attack. And Sybil, if you know, is like when you have like personality schizophrenia disorder. So you basically have multiple clients doing different things on the network and basically obfuscating what they're really doing. And it could be that they're, you know, doing this in order to do a denial of service attack or preventing other miners from mining so that they can always collect the money. But this is known as a Sybil attack. You also have, the ability when you have like a certain hash outputs to try to do some pre-computation. But this is also something that, is identified by a protocol weakness that should be fixed again by the protocol. So when you have a lot of computers, or you have like really fast computers, you always lose against the rest of the system, and in order to actually win, because the thing is, the assumption is, even with as many computers as you want, you can't win, because there'll be enough other people in this distributed system that you can't actually take control. And you would need to take control over more than half of all the computing power that was available in order to actually do this kind of outright control. And that's like a math race. And it's really something that is considered not very feasible to do. It's a concern, but it's not very feasible and it's not very likely. There's also a lot of mining pools, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, but there are Ponzi schemes associated with a lot of the people in that ecosystem. Because there's so many players that also want a piece of this pie, they're trying to figure out if some of them can get an unfair share of that pie. They want to make more money by scamming and frauding than by legitimately enabling the use of a Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency. So you also have scam crowd miners there. It goes kind of with the mining pools. And unfortunately, when we look at implementations of the protocol, we still manage to fail when it comes to security in terms of design as well as build of hardware and software. And there are basic crypto implementation flaws which we're fixing as we go along. There's also this case that, we need to hold this stuff and we need to transfer this money or this value. And there are some compromises where we just screw up. But here's the deal. When you screw up in real life and you kind of lose your bank pass, you call your bank, right? You go, I lost my pass. Please give me a new one. I need a new code, blah, 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 and it works. Here, you can't do that. If you lose your key, it's gone. And this is a real issue, and it's a large issue. If you lose your key, it's gone. So, you know, this can be advertent or can be inadvertent, because there's also social engineering attacks that actually try to make you inadvertently also compromise your key. And there are also malicious miners out there, which we're going to talk about. Oh, I do want to say something. Today, how many of you use Coinbase? Okay, so you got that mail today, in the mail, about... Yeah, you read the story. So Coinbase, they're actually using a SIM swap. Let me explain what, did you understand what it was? Yeah, I'm going to explain it to everybody else what happened here. So it's a little combination of a couple of these vectors. So Coinbase is an exchange where you can actually exchange and trade your cryptocurrency. Imagine, though, that you've got a social engineer who wants to kind of have access to your money. They just want your money. But the way that they're going to do it is they're going to try to steal part of that two-factor authentication or that SMS that was sent to you in order to, like, pretend that you're you. And usually in order to do this, they need to kind of go to the mobile phone operator and say, yeah, I'd like to do a SIM swap. But you can't just go do a SIM swap. You need to get information. You know, there are security questions usually at the mobile operator before you can do that. So what do? They go to the they first call you. They've social engineered you. Then they call the mobile operator. They give the information that you just nicely gave them. And then they do a SIM swap. They intercept the information that was supposed to go to you. And there you go. They're usually in your Coinbase account. So this is a real issue. And Coinbase notified all their users today about the problem. And it's a real worry. But, you know, when you look at the double spend thing, one of the really good things, for example, blockchain does is they monitor the last 200 double spends to look whether it was an actual double spend or not. Because just because you're monitoring for it doesn't mean it actually happened. It means that you're looking for evidence of potential abuse. So, you know, when you take a look at who you work with, these are the kinds of things you want to check for. When it comes to things like malicious miners, again, I was talking about Zcash, right? It's a cryptocurrency, it's very cool, it shields, you know, who's actually using the cryptocurrency, because it adds additional benefits with security and privacy, it uses zero-knowledge proofs in order to get information, and it also allows a sort of secure transport layer over Bitcoin. So what has been happening is Kaspersky's actually noticed that there's malware being sent to people, because you can actually mine Zcash on your computer. On your own computer, you can mine Zcash. So what's happening? There's malware. It's being propagated. It gets on your computer, and it's basically mining in the background. So if your machine is slow, it's probably because it may be mining for Zcash. So Kaspersky put out a list of IOCs and places where you can look for actually this file being run, neqminer.exe, and you can see if Zcash is being mined on your system. So these are malicious miners that are just there from malware. And when you look at the security concerns, there's also what I was trying to tell you about, you know, people trying to take more control via their mining pool than is allowed. Because the idea is if they can calculate a lot of blocks in one go, the rest of us have an issue. So if you take a look, Antpool is a very big miner, but there's also some bad miners in between that are actually using the Ponzi scheme. What you should realize is that there is a continuous check on the amount of mining pools and how they're mining in order to prevent abuse by any single pool. So there are people in the financial system who say, yeah, great, distributed ledger, mutual, lovely, public, open, and their reaction is, cool, now let's close it. Let's no longer make it distributed. Let's close it off. Let's no longer make it completely public because I want to privatize this thing. So this is the knee-jerk reaction of a lot of established financial institutions, because also what they feel they can do when they want to do this is give a higher level of control and security. Sounds logical. Sounds like they want to do it for the right reasons. But I'm really deeply suspicious of this, and I also think that there's a way here just to make more money. However, there may be use cases where very legitimately between financial institutions, for example, that if they also want to make a transition towards blockchain, that this will be the way that they do it. You know, this is their toe dip in the water and their warm bath where they feel comfortable when it's a private system rather than entering the full-fledged public system in one go. It might be their stepping stone. So there are some very different features between, you know, the public and private systems. I think the ones that I'd like you to focus on, two things. The private system does have some benefits over the public system, even though I'm making it sound really negative. One of them is faster, and the second one is you really have pre-approved participants in your system. So you're trying to limit the amount of potential money laundering, fraud, and all kinds of other types of abuse of power. So that's pretty funky. And in terms of wallets, you've got a bunch of choices out there, and the security terms, like what you're worried about is that lost key or stolen key principle on these wallets. The ones that I particularly think are very funky are the brain wallet, where you just remember like a set of words, you know, and they don't make up a phrase. It says it makes a phrase. It doesn't make a phrase. They're like different words, like 12 words that you need to remember. And when you remember those words, that's your key. You just hold it in there and you're good to go. And the other one is a hardware wallet, which is also good. A lot of large exchanges that are holding a lot of information about Bitcoins, they actually prefer something called cold storage. So they're not online all the time, but they have some information cold storage, which makes them less pervious to hacking. So if you take a look at the kind of losses, is the value of the lost Bitcoins was over $950 million. That's not any kind of money to sneeze at. We need to get better at doing this. So, you know, what we need to also figure out is when we're working with exchanges, their ability to influence the exchange. So if you remember the Libor banking scandal where there was, you know, currency like manipulation, imagine that happening between these Bitcoin currencies. So you really want to look at what is the amount of power of the most highest ranking exchanges, what's the volume of transactions they do, and what's their total trades per minute. If you look at that, then you know what their capability is, at least, to do some sort of exploitation. When we actually want to talk about mining for coins, it's not equal. Bitcoins are not created equal on there, because when we started out, you know, there's an evolution in mining. You could start mining with Bitcoin with just your CPU, so just your computer. The olden days, you could have started. But then we went to like very like specifically rigged mining rigs that you had to build yourself with GPU, FPGA, and ASICs like Antminer. And now we're in a new place of evolution. Although this is no longer feasible because it's not profitable for Bitcoin, you can do this with some of the other alternative currencies. An example is Zcash, but another example is Ethereum or Litecoin. And when you look, you could also do things like pooled mining. I showed you about the pooled miners before. You can hang out with your BFFs and convince them to mine with you. Okay, you know, sharing is caring when it comes to making and mining for cryptocurrency. The other thing you could do is find yourself a cloud farm. This one's in China. He looks very happy with his cloud farm. I don't know, let's say. And this one is in Iceland. And this is the Genesis Cloud Farm, and I'm forgetting the name of this one, but the Genesis Cloud Farm is actually very reputable. It's been there for a while, and it's actually a really interesting proposition. One of the issues with profitability is, of course, the energy costs. That's why Tumin Brothers and the guys in Iceland, these guys are using like water energy, and these guys are using geothermal energy. In the UK and in the Netherlands, where I'm from, we have some of the highest energy costs in the world. It doesn't make sense to have a lot of mining rigs, you know, and pay for the energy companies to do that. So unless you're on some form of neutral power, don't go making ginormous mining rigs. You can better pool or buy or just cloudify it. Okay, so by the way, I want to show you this. You can calculate, like for example, for Ethereum and some of the other ones, a profitability. So you take a look at, you know, or you do a GPU, or you just put in your raw hashing rate, like how many can you do, 100 per second, how many can you do? And you take a look at the hash rate, you take a look at your thing, and look, I want to point out something. At this time, for Ethereum, if you had 100, yeah, megahertz per second, then you could get 6,600 a year. When you actually do for 100 megahertz, when you buy that in cloud capacity at Genesis, guess how much it costs? I'm gonna pick on someone who looks sleepy. How much does it cost? Well, you don't look sleepy at all. I'm just going to pick on you because we're up here. How much does it cost? You can get 6,000. How much would you pay for that? What's a valuable return on investment? Come on, guys. 50%. And you're right. So you spend $2,700 at Genesis, you get back, and this is the old Bitcoin price, is $6,660. That's at the current rates. If the price of Ethereum goes up, you make more. It's 100%. It's pretty darn cool, and this is why people are interested. So how many of you have Bitcoin again? How many of you are going to go look at it now? How many savings accounts do you have where you have 100% return on investment? All right, okay, I'm just saying. By the way, it sounds like I'm totally like getting you all on Bitcoin and on Genesis. That's not what I mean to do. I was supposed to be explaining the security risks, but yes. Because there are some spectacular failures that you need to think about. One of them is Mt. Gox, which started out, you know, with Magic the Gathering things they were exchanging initially, and then after several hacks, one started before this poor guy even bought Mt. Gox, they had like a huge amount. I think it was something like 450 million in losses because they got hacked and they got their Bitcoins exposed. Another one is DAO, which is built on top of Ethereum for the smart contracts. There was actually a recursive call fraud in this, which made it possible for people to actually like divert cash. And it was not supposed to be able to be possible, but they were, which it actually resulted in a changing of the protocol in order to prevent against future attacks. So I gave you a bunch of stuff about, you know, what the possibilities are, how interesting it is, the fact that you can get a lot of return, but also that there's a lot of things to be careful of. The wallets have problems, the exchanges have problems, the protocol may have flaws, the crypto implementation may be screwed up. So there's no sorting hat, because there's no one coin that you can say, all right, let me figure out which coin is the best for me to mine right now and how to mine it, or if I should just buy some Bitcoins and speculate that they will increase in price. It's not that easy, but there's a lot of people that still want to do this. How many of you still want to do this? Really? Have I convinced you all not to? There's like three people. Okay. One big caveat emptor, buyer beware. This was in a London taxi. This is a place for Bitcoin whales, which means that like the very large institutional investors are very interested in Bitcoin because of several reasons, one of them being that the other participants are relatively naive of financial systems. So this is a very big buyer beware. It is not without risks. There's a high degree of volatility and fluctuation in the Bitcoin market and the other cryptocurrencies, so this is not something that you should tread into too lightly. And the last question, when are we gonna actually get to a place? What's this pioneering frontier? Well, I think around 2025, and that's when we're gonna have much more adoption of all of these different use cases and all of these different cases from economics to policy need to be solved in order for us to get there. Thank you so much for your patience. Thank you. I don't think we have time for questions, but do you have any?
We have time.
Oh, we have 1 minute for one question. It's you. Here. She's running.
As it becomes harder to calculate or to mine as it grows in size, how does that then work with the non-cryptocurrency, so the other uses for blockchain? Doesn't it become a problem for those? Because what's the incentive for the mining of those other things?
So right now there's about 730 different active cryptocurrencies. Not all of them are difficult to mine. It's only Bitcoin which is reaching a particular saturation point, and the estimation is that over 4 years it will not be possible at all to mine for Bitcoins because that saturation point will have been hit. So, but there are lots of other things you can still mine for. You can mine for Zcash, you can mine for Litecoin, and the expectation is that it will just be a currency value held. Again, price is determined on people who want to buy and sell in this currency and use it, and the amount of acceptance there is. So you're always making a bet. So the idea is, in the future, will it still be Bitcoin, or will it be Zcash with its anonymity features? Will it be Ethereum with its ability to add with, you know, DAO and do smart contracts? So we're betting here. It's still a very volatile market for cryptocurrencies. You know, there's a lot of detractors who think that it's just evil. So the point is, you can mine now, You can also even mine on Bitcoin. It's just not going to deliver you very much if you have lots of energy costs and hardware costs and everything else. So it's really up to you. Would you like to mine or buy? Thank you. Just find me afterwards. Thank you so much. Thank you.